Let's come back to our motivation. And if you find after this morning's talk that there's some areas where you still hold a grudge or you hold some resentment against a person or a group of people or a social policy or whatever, then try to look at the people involved in that as living beings who want happiness and don't want suffering, and who did that action or think in that way because of their own confusion. So instead of seeing them as people who have power over you, instead of seeing them as people who can make you do something, because they can't make you do anything, see them as suffering sentient beings, confused sentient beings, who think that harming others or getting their own way is actually going to bring them happiness, when in fact it's just going to create negative karma and more disturbance in their mind. So change the view of how you see those people. As you release your anger and hostility towards them, see if you can cultivate some compassion. Compassion simply being the wish for them to not suffer and to not have the causes of suffering. So you're not saying what they did was okay. You're just wishing them to be free of the suffering that causes them to do harmful things. And imagine them being free of that suffering. And then, elaborating on that compassion, generate the bodhicitta motivation to become a fully awakened Buddha, so that you'll have the wisdom, the compassion, and from your own side, the ability, the power to benefit others most effectively. And make that motivation for listening to teachings.
Ah.
release some of that anger, do you feel better yourself? You do, don't you? Yeah. So anger and grudge holding actually is self-torment. And the more we're able to release it, then the more peaceful we ourselves are. So forgiveness is not something that we give to the other person. They don't need our forgiveness. We need our forgiveness. Because forgiveness simply means that we're putting down our anger. Yeah. So similarly, when we've harmed others, we need to apologize to them, or if they aren't around anymore or they don't want to see us, we need to acknowledge, you know, what we did and have regret for it. But their forgiveness is not what we need. It's we need to forgive ourselves for doing that. Okay? Because otherwise we get stuck in, well, I harm somebody else and I can't feel peace about it until they forgive me. But that person, maybe they're dead, maybe they're stuck in their own anger. Yeah, they're still not seeing the situation in a clear manner. And then we get stuck because we can't put it down and we stay guilt-ridden. Okay. So it's not a question of them forgiving us or us forgiving them. It's a question of really all of us forgiving ourselves. And yes, it is better and it does feel nice when other people apologize. But we don't need their apology in order to forgive them. Because if we tell ourselves we need their apology and we can't forgive until they apologize, then who's going to suffer? Can we make them apologize? Yeah. Then that's just saying, you know, I'm going to torment myself until, you know, holding on to anger against them until they apologize to me. And, you know, that's ridiculous. When are they going to apologize? Yeah, if you flip it, have we apologized for everything that we've done? Okay. Are you getting what I'm saying here? Yeah? So, it's, it's a process we do within ourselves. The important thing is that in our own hearts, we feel clean, clear. We can't control what the other person feels. Yeah? We can apologize to them. They may not forgive us. Their lack of forgiveness is their suffering. Our being able to apologize is our clearing away the mess from our side. Similarly, if somebody's wronged us, our forgiveness is letting go of our anger. This making some sense to you? Because we often hang on to this idea that we can't forgive until they apologize. Okay. And we have these whole visions of how they should apologize. Yeah. So we're sitting there and they come. come through the door crawling on their hands and legs, going, "Culpa mia, culpa mia, I hurt you, I'm so sorry, it's all my fault, please forgive me." And then we can look at them and say, "Well, I'm glad you finally realized what you did. May you burn in hell." But you caught me in a good mood, and I'm going to forgive you. Yeah? You know, don't you have those visualizations? You know, how your ex-husband is going to come and finally admit that he caused the whole mess and that you are an innocent victim. Yeah. What does that get us? Yeah? What does that get us? No, it's not one person's fault. It's the whole dynamic that we all contributed to. And we have to own our own part. I mean, you have so many nice, you know, in your meditation, beautiful daydream of how somebody, you know, your mother, your father, your boss, whoever it is, how they're going to apologize to you. Yeah, when is that going to happen? Yeah? When's that going to happen? And are you vowing to hold on to your anger until they apologize? And if you vow to hold on to your anger, who's hurt? Us. So I really stress this. I come from a wonderful family that passes down grudges from one generation to the next. Yeah. And I, as a kid, you know, watching my grandmother's generation, and she and her siblings not talking to each other, and So they didn't talk to each other, so their kids didn't talk to each other, so I wasn't supposed to talk to any of them either. Yeah. And like, why can't I talk to those other kids? Well, just be quiet, don't talk to them. But why? Yeah, they didn't do anything to me. And then on my parents' generation, yeah, brothers and sisters started quarreling, not speaking to each other. Yeah, planning a family event in my family. You know, trying to make a seating arrangement. This one doesn't talk to that one, who doesn't talk to this one, who doesn't. You know, it's totally crazy. And then watching on my generation the same thing happening. Yeah, siblings, you know, over some tiny thing, then not talking to each other anymore. And then seeing how when parents act like this, what they're basically doing is telling their children, when you grow up, you should fight and not speak to each other. Because kids learn by watching the example of their parents. Yeah. And so I just remember as a kid hearing my parents criticize their brothers and sisters. And I didn't realize it at the time because I was thinking, you know, I don't want to be like that. But then watching, you know, and I'm sure the other families were all criticizing my family too, you know. And then watching, you know, when you have that example of your parents acting that way, then the next generation, yeah, they quarrel with each other too. Now, if parents were smart, you know, would you want your kids who you love, to fight and not speak together? No, you want your kids to be in harmony. But when you criticize your relatives in front of your kids, and you don't speak to your relatives, that's what you're telling your children to do when they get older. And so, you know, this is the same dynamic that goes on in Yugoslavia when, you know, it broke up into so many smaller groups. You know, throughout the planet, what do people do? They fight because 300 years ago, their ancestors fought. Yeah, it's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, holding on to these grudges as if the people who were alive are the ones who harmed you. And yet this is, you know, what we do in society. And so for hundreds of years, like the Turks and the Armenians, yeah, the Turks, you know, there was genocide. Why can't the Turks say, yeah, our ancestor made a big mistake? Why can't they say it? They're not the ones who made the mistake. But from the side of the Armenians, why are they holding it on and making themselves miserable? Yeah, because, I'll tell you why. Because an enemy, having an enemy gives us an identity. Yeah, we have a very strong feeling of I and a very strong feeling of my group when there's somebody else outside that we can push against. You know, they harm me. So this is my group and we hate them. So now I have an identity. I'm the one victimized by them. And I also have a group because we were all victimized together. Now we know who we are. Now we know the purpose of our life. Revenge! You know, this is craziness, isn't it? Craziness, but you study human history and this is exactly what happens. Yeah. So, as Dharma practitioners, we want to opt out of that dynamic. Yeah, I am voluntarily choosing to opt out. Yeah. I don't want to create enemies. I don't want to hate the people that my ancestors hated. Yeah, I want to cultivate loving kindness towards everybody. Yeah. And then you do what you know in your heart is best. And some people look at you and say, you're crazy. Don't you realize what those people are going to do if they take power? But do we want to live our lives overwhelmed by hatred, overwhelmed by fear? I don't know about you, but I don't. Okay? So this is all about letting go of the anger. And when we think about it, you like to be judged on the basis of the worst thing you ever did in your life? Yeah? Would you want everybody's opinion of you to be based on one action that you did at one time that happened to be the worst thing in your life that you did? No, we're much more than the worst thing we did in our life. We can look back on that and say, wow, I made a huge mistake. Yeah, and I'm going to learn from my mistake, and I'm not going to do that again. But please don't think that that's the story of my entire life, and that's all my life was worth. Yeah, because it's not. So I remember one time, I was working on a project with somebody, and somebody else, the leader of this group, was going to let us do a presentation to this large group, and at the last moment, he changed his mind and said there wasn't enough time. And I was mad. Yeah. And I held on to a grudge against this guy for several years about something that took 5 minutes of his life, which was deciding not to let me and my friend make a presentation. So that was definitely the worst thing he ever did in his life. Definitely, by all means, you know? Definitely the worst thing he ever did in his life. And I was mad about it. So much wasted time, so much wasted energy. Yeah. Because it takes a lot of energy to hate someone and to be mad at somebody for a long time. It takes a lot of energy. And that energy could be used in much better endeavors, but we keep it all like this. Yeah. So that's why they call us afflictive sentient beings. We are afflicted by anger and attachment and confusion. Okay. That's why we are polluted sentient beings. Our mind is polluted by these poisonous attitudes, these poisonous emotions. Yeah. But, as we were saying this morning, these things are not the nature of our mind. They're like the dirt in the glass of clear water. They're like the clouds in a clear sky. Okay? So they can be eliminated. They're not the nature of the mind. Why can they be eliminated? Because they are all based on misconception. They're all based on a fundamental ignorance that misapprehends how things exist. So because this misapprehension is a misapprehension, and things do not exist in the way ignorance thinks they exist, therefore, when we generate wisdom, it can overcome the ignorance. When the ignorance falls, then the other afflictions that depend on it also crumble. Okay. So, what is this view of ignorance, the way things don't exist, the way they appear to? It's coming in our chapter, if I read faster. Okay, so be patient. Because I want to read this because, you know, what it's the way His Holiness speaks is quite powerful. So we were talking about how the mind can be colored by different emotions. Some of them are negative, they're based on ignorance. Some of them are constructive, they're not based on ignorance. But none of them are in the nature of the mind. Okay. Then he says, our body is like a house, and the mind is its inhabitant. Do you ever think of your body as like a guest house? And your mind is living in it temporarily, but it's going to move out soon. good if we think that way because, you know, we are mortal beings and we're not going to live in this body forever. We're going to die and our consciousness is going to separate. Yeah? So it's kind of like, you know, we can get an eviction notice at any time. Because the cause of death, it just comes like, it can come like that, can't it? You know, totally unexpected. Most of the people who died today didn't expect to die today. Yeah. Okay, so the body is like a house and the mind is its inhabitant. As long as the body remains, the mind is a long-term resident. However, various mental factors, which include emotions and attitudes, are like visitors. One day resentment comes, another day compassion comes, but neither remains long. While both are visitors, one visitor is respectful, useful, and pleasant, like someone reliable whom we can trust and want to make a member of the family. We invite that visitor to remain in the house all the time and cultivate the conditions so that she will. So, the visitor of compassion, the visitor of fortitude, the visitor of generosity, we want to invite those into our mind. Meanwhile, the other visitor is rude and disturbs our own and others' peace. Anger, clinging attachment, jealousy, arrogance. They're that rude visitor. We don't want him or her, we don't want him to visit, let alone move in. So we do not invite him in and evict him if he sneaks in. Similarly, it is possible to banish anger and cultivate compassion limitlessly, making it our constant companion. Okay. So that's what we want to do. And that's a good purpose in our life, isn't it? To banish anger and cultivate compassion. Yeah. I think that's a better purpose in life than making a lot of money or being very famous. Yeah. Because you make a lot of money, as Lama Yeshe, my teacher, used to say, come, come, go, go. That's what happens with money. Come, come, go, go. Yeah. If we can develop compassion and kindness and tolerance, yeah, and keep them firm in the mind, then they come, come. Yeah. And there's not the anger there that interferes with them being there. Okay, so there he was talking about the conventional nature of the mind. Now he's going to shift to the ultimate nature of the mind, which is its emptiness of independent or inherent existence. So inherent existence is a false mode of existence that we superimpose on all phenomena. We believe that they have their own findable essence that makes them what they are, and that they exist independently of all other factors, such as their causes and parts. Okay, so that's how we see things. Now, when you look out and you see people, they all look like independent, objective people, don't they? Yeah, when you look, just look around the room. There's a real person there. When you look at somebody, do you think that's a mind that's temporarily inhabiting that body? Yeah? You look, oh, there's a mind temporarily inhabiting the body. No, we don't think that. We think there's a person from their own side, independent of our even perceiving them or conceiving of them. Okay. In fact, it's just a mind that's moved into a body for a while. Yeah. But that seems very impersonal. We want a person, you know, there's something magical about a person. But what does a person do that the body and mind can't do? Yeah. We say, here I am. I'm here. Well, what's actually here is just a body and mind. And everything that we say, I do, that the person does, is actually done by either the body or the mind. There's no separate person kind of hiding around inside of here. Some homunculus, where was that supposed to be, in our pituitary gland, you know, or some soul, you know, somewhere in our heart. There's nothing like that. Yeah, that's all a projection of our mind, that there's some real person. Yeah, there's just a body and mind. And there is a person, but that person exists because we just give a name to that combination of body and mind. Okay, so instead of saying, there's, you know, the person with long brown hair who's, you know, 1.5 meters tall, wearing, you know, blue shirt, walking down the street, that takes a long time to say. It's easier to say, you know, Sam is walking down the street. Okay, so there is a person, but that person exists simply because we've looked at the body and mind and made them into a collection that functions together, that we give the name, you know, whatever your name is. Okay. But there's nothing inside the body and mind that is some kind of separate, special person, the essence of me. So we feel like there's something, there's me somewhere in here. But as soon as you start searching for me and try and grab it, can you grab something that's me? Yeah? Are you your little toe? Yeah? Are you, yeah, the tip of your nose? Are you your esophagus? Are you your stomach? Or your brain? Yeah. Is there one part of the body that you can say, this is me? The me there. Yeah. How about in our mind? Is there one part, one aspect of our mind? Are you your anger? If we're our anger, then that means we should always be angry. Because I and anger would be synonymous and perform the same function. So then we should always be angry. That doesn't happen. Are you the consciousness that sees, that hears? Are you the consciousness that thinks? Oh yes, I think, therefore I am. Yeah. Which consciousness that thinks? The consciousness that thinks about oatmeal in the morning? Is that who you are? Yeah. The consciousness that voted for whoever you voted for? Which consciousness are you? Okay, so when we look and try and find something we can isolate that is really my essence, always there. You know, this thing that's me, that's never going to go out of existence. Yeah? What do you find? Zero. Isn't it? We don't find anything when we search. When we don't search, there's the appearance of different things, and we give them names, and we use names, and we use words, and we use concepts, but there's no essence to the things that the names and the concepts refer to. There's nothing in this that makes it a clock. Yeah. Even though when we look at it, we say clock as if there were clockness radiating from it. But there's no clockness radiating from it. Yeah. We have just all agreed to call it a clock. And we've all agreed that the word clock refers to something that tells time. Yeah, so we can use language. But is there something in this that's a clock? No. Okay, so the part of our mind, the ignorance, thinks that everything has its own essence that exists independent of everything else. In actual fact, things exist, but they exist empty of that kind of essence. They exist dependent on their causes and conditions, on their parts, and also on our conceiving and giving them a name that we all agree on. Okay? So things exist dependent. They don't exist independent. So ignorance thinks that they have an independent essence. And on the basis of thinking that things have their own independent essence, then we develop all sorts of other wrong views about them. Yeah? Like, oh, somebody gave me this bottle 2 days ago in Hamburg. They gave me a bottle of coconut water. Did I tell you this? Yeah. And it says, there is happiness inside this. Yeah? So that coconut water has the essence of happiness in it. Yeah. It's just water with, I don't know, some coconut stuff in it? That's all. And yet, now it's become, you know, the rage. It's become nirvana. You know? And we look at it, and there's happiness inside that coconut water. But I think they've got it all wrong, because I think happiness exists inside chocolate. Yeah? What do you think? Chocolate, isn't it? Chocolate. Much better than coconut. Okay. And now they're even showing that chocolate can be good for you, despite all the fat in it, despite the number of calories, you know. Now they're finding a way to say that all the cacao is good for us. Yeah. Smart people. Yeah. Well, that's the definition of smart, isn't it? Anybody who agrees with what I like. Anybody who agrees with my ideas. That's the definition of smart. Yeah. Stupid is somebody who disagrees with my ideas. Yeah. And we laugh, but this is the way we look at life, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, somebody who voted for Donald Trump, I hope none of you did. So we have these things, you know, we impute things, you know, ways of existing to other people, to phenomena. Then we develop expectations of them. And of course, our expectations are never met. So then we're disappointed, we get angry, we blame the object. Okay? So all of our samsara, our constantly recurring problems, operate in this way. Okay. So the ultimate nature of the mind is its emptiness of all that stuff. Okay. In fact, phenomena are empty of all such fabricated ways of existing, because they exist dependent on other factors. The 8,000 line Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, in that sutra, the Buddha says, the mind is devoid of mind, for the nature of the mind is clear light. That sounds like hogwash, doesn't it? The mind is devoid of mind. What do you mean the mind is devoid of mind? You know, for the nature of mind is clear light. Clear light? Okay. So the scriptures contain all such clear statements that we have to, this is why we receive teachings, because we have to learn what these statements mean. Okay, so the mind is devoid of mind. This leads us to investigate what the mind actually is, its ultimate mode of existence, how it really exists. So the mind refers to the clear and cognizant conventional nature of the mind. We talked about that this morning. When we search for that clear and cognizant nature, we cannot find something that is the mind. Yeah. When we search for exactly what our mind is, we can't pinpoint one thing, because the mind is constantly changing. Moment by moment by moment by moment. It's different in each nanosecond. It doesn't even abide until the next moment. Okay. So when we look for something that's really there, it's not really there in the next moment. When we search that clear and cognizant nature, we cannot find something that is the mind. Within the clarity and cognizance, there is nothing we can pinpoint that is inherently the mind. If we were able to find a real mind, then the mind would inherently exist with its own independent essence. However, when we search to find the mind, we do not find the mind in the mind. We do not find, and not finding the mind in the mind means we can't find an inherently existent mind in the conventional mind. Okay. That is why it says here that the mind is devoid of mind. The final nature of the mind, its ultimate mode of existence, is its emptiness of inherent existence. Okay? So, if we take the clock, yeah, here we can say the clock is devoid of clock. Okay? Meaning that here's the clock, but when we examine inside this thing, is there anything we can point to that is the clock? Yeah, if we took it apart piece by piece, Is there anything that we could point to and say, that's the clock? There's nothing. Yeah. It's just a bunch of diverse parts that we put together. But even the collection of those parts is not the clock. Because until we agree, yeah, that this performs a certain function and we're going to give a certain word to this, yeah, then it doesn't really, it can't really be a clock. Yeah. So what we're also getting at is that phenomena exist in relationship to our mind. It's our mind that looks at them and puts the pieces together and sees an object. But we're creating that. And, you know, if you've ever studied early childhood development, you know that babies, well, you know how we put the little things above their crib, you know, the floating things? The babies, you know, they see those things and it's just a bunch of colors. Yeah? And when they look at the wall there, it's also just a bunch of colors. Yeah? It takes the mind to put things together to see an object there. So the baby doesn't see, what do you call those little things? The things that hang? There's a name for them.
Mobile.
Mobiles, yeah. So the baby doesn't say, oh, there's a mobile. Yeah. The baby just sees colors. It doesn't see them as somehow things that are related to each other, attached by strings that serve a certain purpose. Okay? Babies, when they cry, they are scared of their own cry because they don't realize they're making the cry. Yeah? There's no sense that that awful, frightening sound is coming from me. Yeah? So, you know, so much of our education is basically learning names and concepts. But then we forget that we were the ones that put the pieces together. We're the ones who look at everything here and call it a room. We forget that. And we think there is a room from its own side, somewhere inside those walls. Yeah, but where's the room? Can you point to the room we're sitting in? Yeah. When we search for the room we're sitting in, what are you going to point to that we're sitting in? Yeah, we can't isolate something that is the room. And yet, when we're not analyzing, when we're just talking conventionally, where are we? We're in the room. And we all understand that. Okay? So there's no room in the room when we analyze for what the room is. But we are all still sitting in the room. Okay. Or as my teacher used to say, there is no clock in this object, but there is a clock on the table. Yeah, there's no clock in this object is referring to the ultimate nature of the clock. But there is a clock on the table is referring to conventionally there's a clock that's on this table, and if we say to somebody, please bring me the clock on the table, we understand each other. But there's no clock in this. Yeah. This is empty of clock. Yeah. And this is empty of person. Yeah. This is empty of children. Yeah. Yes, I have a passport. Yes, I have a driver's license. That proves that this is me. But there's no me. Okay? There's no me in this mess. Yeah. Even though there's a passport. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But, doesn't everyone have the nature, one's own nature?
No, we don't have one's own nature.
Like they say, this type of tree grows for sure in this way, has these leaves and so on, and another tree for sure those leaves.
Wait, do they want you to use the microphone? Hold on.
Oh, no. I just asked if not everybody has their own nature.
Yeah, no. We don't have our own nature. We're constantly changing phenomena. Are you the same person as you were when you were 5 years old? Are you the same person as you were when you were 5 days old? How about if you live to be 95? Are you going to be the same person? If we each had some nature that was really us, then we should be able to see what it is, and it should be there at every single moment of our life. But, you know, in terms of our body, what is it? Every 7 years, all the cells have changed in our body. And with our mind, I mean, we don't even need to wait 7 years. Our mind is changing like this. Okay? So one way we box ourselves in is by thinking that we have a concrete nature. So like I was saying this morning, somebody who says, well, I'm just an angry person. That's the way I am. You're married to me. Just tough it up because I'm an angry person. Yeah? And that's rubbish. Yeah, that's total rubbish. In the same way as when we say to ourselves, I'm a failure. I'm unlovable. I can't do anything right. All that kind of self-talk is based on thinking that there's something there that is all of that. Okay? But if you look, like, what in here is a failure? Yeah? Is my big intestine a failure? Yeah? Are my toenails failures? Is my thumb a failure? Is my eye consciousness a failure? Is the consciousness that sleeps at night a failure? Who in the world am I attributing failure to? Yeah, you can't pinpoint something. Yeah. Because there's lots of parts of us that do things perfectly well and are competent. So who in the world is this failure? Okay, so we're conceptually creating all sorts of stuff and then thinking that's who we are. And we're not.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Could you please explain in your words then what from me is coming from the last life and is going on to the next one?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I remember seeing a movie once about, what was it? Some guy who died and then he got reborn as the family dog. So in Hollywood, you know, the way they did it, this guy died, I don't know, in a car accident or something. And then something kind of like came out of here, some ambiguous cloud, and then went over there and went kerplunk into the dog's body. And then the dog showed up at the house, you know, with the wife and the kids. Yeah. So, yeah, very good movie. Okay. It's not like that. It's not like that. It's not Hollywood. Yeah. It's one moment of consciousness is the substantial cause, the thing that becomes the next moment of consciousness. But consciousness at this moment and consciousness at that moment are different consciousnesses, but they are related because one moment of consciousness is the cause for the other. So they're not totally unrelated. It's not like one moment of my consciousness and one moment of your consciousness. Those are unrelated. Yeah, but within my own mental continuum, one moment brings the next moment. But each moment is different than the preceding moment. There's nothing permanent that continues from one moment to the next. So at the time of death, yeah, death being the last moment of when the mind is affiliated with this guest house of the body. Yeah. At that time, all of our grosser sense consciousnesses have ceased to function. And there's just an extremely subtle consciousness at that time. And that consciousness leaves one body, but it's changing in the next moment. And it goes into the intermediate state. And then it keeps changing all moment by moment throughout the intermediate state until the causes and conditions come together, until it's attracted to a body and it gets reborn in that body. Yeah. So there's a continuum of the karma of our actions. Yeah. The karmic seeds, the quote-quote energy traces that are left over from our actions. There's a continuity, you know, because of them, so that the actions I do, I'm the one who experiences the result. But the one who creates the cause is not exactly the same person as the one who experiences the result. But they exist in the same continuum. In the same way as the person who cheated on their final exam is not the same person who got their paper back with an F. Okay? There's a relationship, one caused the other, but they're not exactly the same. There's no essence that went from the person who's cheated to the person who got an F. Yeah. So, you know, part of our problem is we really make everything very concrete. Very concrete. And a lot of what we argue about in our lives with other people are the terms that we're going to cause something. That's what we fight about. Like in a court of law, is this person guilty or innocent? We spend millions of dollars deciding what name to attach to that person. Guilty or innocent. And then whatever is decided by the court of law, somebody doesn't agree. We spend a lot of time and energy deciding what you call dirt. Okay? What you call dirt. I remember when I was, years ago, I was leading a retreat in Israel, and it was at a kibbutz in the Negev Desert. And the kibbutz was right on the border with Jordan. So, you know, the room I was staying is in here. Here's the fence, the chain link fence, that's the border. And here is a no man's land where they rake the sand so that if anybody tries to step on it to go one way or the other over the border, their footprints are there. And then beyond that, then there's more sand. So people fight wars over, you know, is this sand Jordan or is it Israel? And this sand, is it Jordan or is it Israel? We kill each other over what name to attach to sand. It's totally nuts, isn't it? And I've always wondered, because it's windy there, and this sand, which is Israel, blows over the fence, and now it's in Jordan. You know, so is the Israeli government going to say, give us our sand back? Or are they going to say, Israel is there, so now we have a right to put the fence over there because that sand was Israeli sand. It was on this side before and now it's on that side. And then Jordan's going to say, no, our sand is there, so Jordan is over there. Yeah? And then the little bits of sand are going to, am I Jordan? Am I Israel? Which am I? We're next to each other, but I don't know which I am. I have an identity crisis. Okay, so I think that's a good place to start. Okay, so we aren't getting very far in this first chapter, but we have another 2 days, okay? But I think useful, huh? Yeah, making you think of a little bit. Okay. So we can dedicate the merit.
Mögen durch die Kraft dieser Bemühungen alle Wesen von zerstörerischen Schulumdenken ablassen und in Freundschaft, Liebe, Mitgefühl und Harmonie zusammennehmen. Mögen alle Wesen Kraft dieser Bemühungen verdienstvolle Handlung und Weisheit sagen können und mögen sie die zwei heiligen Körper erlangen, welche aus verdienstvollen Handlungen und Weisheit entstehen. Möge der Dalai Lama, der große Ozean, der Verwalter der Lehre, erledigen. Möge der Geist der Einsichtsvollen sich wie ein Lotus entfalten und möge unter der Sonne von Lehre und Praxis alle 10 Himmelsrichtungen Glück beschieden sein.